Hello, everybody, and welcome to the China Tech Investor Podcast, powered by TechNode, seeking truth from facts when it comes to Chinese tech stocks and IPO. I'm Elliot Zagman, and with me is a man who, for the first time in over 2 years, is enjoying a North China springtime. It's James Hull.
That's actually accurate because, yeah, I left China in January of 2020. Yeah, and so I haven't been in a spring in 2 years. Yeah, wow, that's, yep. Okay, so nothing said.
You get those nice flowing, was it the nice flowing, like a little, like the cotton balls flowing through the air? You know what I'm talking about?
You get the
those shedding trees that are awful on those of us with allergies. But anyways, disclaimer,
nothing said on this podcast is not investment advice. Do not think that it is or rely on anything said here to make investment decisions. Do that with something else. This podcast is supposed to be a little bit informational and hopefully some entertainment. Yeah, investing is risky.
What was the first meal that you had, the first Chinese meal that you had back in China?
First Chinese meal, it was quarantine food.
Oh, that's not. When you could have gone out yourself, where you could determine it yourself.
We went to a restaurant a few days ago. It was Shuangyang Rou. So like lamb hot pot.
Okay.
And it was awesome.
Oh,
and
nice.
Everything I love about hot pot and spicy food, you know, happened, and it's great. It's like, you know, I love it.
Yeah, there is in my neighborhood in Bangkok, there is a restaurant that had this. They're a brewery, but they had they offered like this like a Sichuan style chicken, and it's hard to get like kind of the mala, like spicy balls, you know. Yep. the spicy peppercorns. Mm-hmm. And they made them and they served them. I love those things. And then so I ordered them like 3 days in a row. But then I was reminded about how my gastrointestinal tract responds to that. And so I haven't gone back there for more of it because that is some punishment. Anyways, techno.com/newsletters for your daily dose of China tech. Yeah, so today we have Stuart Randall. Stuart is a chip expert and is a regular columnist for TechNode, and really is a go-to resource when it comes to semiconductors in China. He's director of operations at Intralink Shanghai, and we're going to talk about all things semiconductors in China with him. But first, we're going to go through, let's just talk about a few of the happenings in the news. One thing that I think we've talked about this before, obviously, but it's really seeming to be the defining theme, I think, of China tech in 2021, and that's regulation. Right, the antitrust after the big crackdown on Alibaba and Ant and all the questions around Jack Ma. What we're also seeing is a series of other crackdowns on, we have an investigation on Meituan, investigation into Tencent, and they're really kind of doing the rounds here. But you made an interesting observation the other day about how you've been following just the theme of data sharing and how much this seems to be kind of the central goals of the regulators during this whole crackdown.
Yeah. So remember when we did our 2021 predictions, one of my predictions was that 2021 is the year China finally gets the data, and it seems to be on track. And maybe I suffer from a little bit of advocacy bias here, but I kind of see this as, you know, kind of the background behind some of these crackdowns is, you know, if you read the articles sort of buried in sometimes the last paragraph or kind of down towards the bottom three quarters, they talk about how there's some entities going to be set up to share the data, or somehow the companies are collecting the wrong data. But if you go and you think about basically like one of the goals China wants to do is this social credit score. And in order to get that, you need to kind of have a central repository of data. They also have the goal of creating better consumer credit analysis, credit reporting, and that's all tied in with the social credit score, obviously. But in order to get those credit reporting groups and companies to do better, they need access to this data that, you know, Ant was holding, Tencent has some. I mean, all the financial fintech firms have their own kind of buckets, and some of them are bigger than others and more useful, but they don't want to share those. And that's kind of obvious because if you have a exclusive ownership of something like that data, it's an advantage. Now, if you have to share it, then your advantage moves from having access to the data to having to create an analysis advantage. It's kind of like how Reg FD changed the U.S. Equity markets. And so basically, I think this is all kind of going to happen at some point this year. And I think, you know, you can see it in the headlines, you can read the articles about it, but we kind of lost the picture because like Jack Ma got up and said all this stuff. And then we had, there was that crazy article about how Xi Jinping personally wanted to, you know, made a decision to kind of hamper Ant's IPO. And I have no idea if this stuff is right or wrong, obviously, but I think behind the scenes, the thing that Ant doesn't want to give up and the thing that just about every other group that's on the credit reporting side, including the banks aren't going to do the analysis themselves, right? They're going to rely on the credit reporting groups. They want it. And so there's kind of this, you know, obviously there's a, it's a big trade-off. It's a big loss for Ant on the one hand and a big potential gain for everybody else. So we see, we see the battle on the front lines, but in the back it's about this, I think.
There's something I think that there is one leads to another, right? that if you already if Jack Ma and Ant already aren't on the best of terms with Beijing, that you know they're probably going to risk you know being targeted, and if they are being targeted, then they're probably not going to be on very good terms with them either, right? It's kind of a vicious cycle.
That's a great point
when it comes to that,
because I mean Ant, they've been wanting this data from Ant, I mean, at least 2 years. It's been going on for quite a while, maybe even longer. And so there's definitely some sort of, you know, frustration there. And then if you look at kind of the state-owned banks, they've been frustrated for even longer just because their business, which was way too cushy to begin with, right? Collecting massive amounts of deposits, paying very little in interest, and then basically lending to groups that will never go bust, right? It's like everything's on both sides of that equation or is perfectly planned, like set up for you. And so, you know, the peer-to-peer guys came, took some of that deposit away. They got kind of smashed because there was a lot of fraud. It wasn't just because you know, that they lost the deposits, but that was part of, you know, the advocacy against them, you know, and in terms of fixing up fraud, it didn't really give them a chance to clean up themselves, right? It just, let's just get rid of this. And so it's a long, long way coming. And certainly, I mean, it's not over yet. I mean, we still need this. The way it'll end, I think, is when this data does eventually get centralized. And that's not an easy task, right? I mean, I think, I forget who it was, but I went to a little meetup in Beijing and these two people had traveled around the country and checked and like been spoken to people who are putting together the social credit score systems and the little trials. And they found out that they're one, all different. No surprise. Two, they're all disconnected. Yeah. Also, no surprise there. And that they're all like collecting very different data and everything's very, very different. So what needs to happen to get all that that credit score system launched is it needs to, you need to kind of standardize all this stuff, get it centralized, which is a big task, but it's not impossible. And, you know, a team,
but you need to have, this is one of those things where like you have to have a very, very strong central authority to be able to do that. Cause this is something that, not from a local government perspective, from a corporate perspective, you know, as we've seen with Ant, but what the, everybody who is not Zhongnan Hai is going to be resisting this because they are giving up power.
Oh, tons of power. Yeah. They're giving up tons. Yeah. which is sort of like the probably the utopian vision of this, right? If there is one, right? There's dystopian utopia.
Yeah.
And the utopian vision of it is that, you know, once they can kind of get that power and then have this sort of oversight and then be able to, you know, knock things and disincentivize things that incentivize other things that they want. I mean, it's kind of like you're the nudging, you know, state, parental states, you know, greatest wish, right? This is like, it's a giant experiment though. And so, yeah, anyway, going a little bit off topic.
I mean, it's not the first situation in which a large central power is like, well, if we only had more power, we could make everything perfect.
Oh, yeah.
Anyways, that's...
the problem is not enough.
That's beside the point. Yes, exactly. So anyways, so moving on, though, we should get to our conversation.
Yeah, so the other one sort of bigger... small piece. It's a small development, but it's kind of, we talked about it with Paul Triolo years, I think it was a while ago now, in a prior episode.
Yeah, that was one of our first episodes.
Yeah. So, the EU has kind of have some new developments on kind of pushing back on China with new regulations that are seeking to, for example, fine companies that are found to have state backed support or subsidies, overseas subsidies. And there's even in there the ability for investigators, your EU investigators, to be able to go overseas and inspect foreign offices, obviously with the company's approval and the domestic state where that foreign office is, their approval as well. But it's kind of interesting. And, you know, in the EU, you know, this is geopolitics, which is unfortunately tied up very much with investing these days. But the EU signs an investment agreement with China and then kind of starts to add these. And this is all domestic, you know, internal affair type things they're doing. But it starts to incrementally make things more difficult incrementally change the terms of what would be, you know, change things from what they were before, right? I think it's kind of like taking a page out of China's playbook, which is, you know, very good at creating, you know, signing, like agreeing to kind of bigger picture stuff, but then when the implementation comes, it's always for some reason a giant surprise to the foreign companies that, for example, like Vanguard seems to be like pulling out back on their China plans because it was so hard for them to get licenses and maybe their business model. It might be based on kind of China's up and down limit rules for their equity markets, but it seems like they're kind of pulling out a little bit. But yeah, so it's this kind of incremental political strategy where it's, yes, let's come together, but then let's also we have these differences. They're not going to be at the top of the in the spotlight, but they're going to be worked on sort of in the background and in sort of a more private fashion. I think it's a smart kind of way to go.
Well, this is a theme that I think we're seeing. It's kind of been the accusation that's been hurled at the U.S. too. It's like, oh, well, the U.S., you know, they advocate for free and open markets, and yet they are applying a lot more of these, you know, kind of Chinese style tactics. But like the way that I see it, though, is that it's kind of natural. It's kind of game theory, right? That yeah. If you have a large, you know, player like that is, you know, doing it that way, and it's a way that it is advantaging them and disadvantaging other players that the other players are incentivized to, you know, apply something similar themselves, right? It's just, it seems to be.
And those tactics work. I mean, it's like, yeah. China has been incredibly successful with these tactics. So, I mean, learning something from it is not necessarily a bad idea, but it does create, you know, if you have these extreme ideological views, then yeah, there's a little bit of
hypocrisy,
you know, holding maybe two ideas in your head. Yeah, yeah. Tons of hypocrisy.
Yeah.
but let's face it, I mean, nobody's really, you know, perfect, and there's hypocrisy everywhere in the world, right?
Right.
It's not like surprise. But anyway.
Yeah, anyways,
that's kind of it on the big picture stuff.
We're going to talk about another area that is heavily impacted by geopolitics with Stuart Randall, and that's China and their semiconductor push right now. So let's go on to our discussion with Stuart Randall. Today on the pod is all about China's semiconductor smorgasbord. And joining us today to talk about that is none other than Stu Randall. Stuart Randall is Director of Operations at Intralink Shanghai. Stuart, thank you for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So right now, it's kind of, there's this kind of semiconductor investment free for all right now in China. I mean, this is kind of a golden time for you, I think, as someone who emphasizes or focuses on semiconductors and semiconductors in China. But tell us about kind of this this kind of frenzy that's going on right now, all this investment that's coming into this space in China, and some of the government policy that has helped to kind of spur this.
Yeah, well, yeah, for, I guess, it's kind of bittersweet for me. Like, it's thrust it into the limelight, and obviously the past few years it's kind of a niche topic. And now suddenly the past couple of years, like everybody's, all the mainstream media is suddenly interested in this, which obviously it wasn't before. And on the other side, yeah, it, in some ways it makes the job more difficult because, you know, there's some firms you can't talk to, or, you know, the market gets a bit smaller if you're like me, helping these Western firms in China. So obviously, I think the government investment here has been going on for quite a while, and I'm sure you can look up the various different big funds that have, and the numbers that involve, like tens of billions.
Entity list, yeah.
But it really, obviously, then you have Made in China 2025 and all that, but it really, obviously, as everyone knows, kicked into gear, like stepped up a gear with the ZTE situation 2 or 3 years ago now. And basically that kind of proved it.
So kind of the U.S. sanctions that, or like the entity list that is essentially cut off their supply of U.S. materials, right?
Yeah, and it proved in a very public way how a large, you know, kind of not a tiny, insignificant company like ZTE could be brought to its knees pretty quickly by the U.S. if the U.S. wanted to. And obviously, for many years, you know, you know, in China, obviously, always talking about how they're, you know, technically advanced and everything's great. You know, you have various films talking about how much China is advanced that people go to see in the cinema. And then very publicly, you can see that, you know, oh dear, there's this switch that can be turned off. So I think that woke some people up in Beijing. And so this kicked into gear even more. Now, I think obviously we've seen Huawei has been able to last longer than ZTE, but its revenue has been dropping. I think its Q1 was something like 16% down from last year. But and also HiSilicon, yeah? I mean, HiSilicon's the real target in the Huawei sense, and it spent that very short amount of time in the top 10 chip companies, and now it's not there at all anymore. And, you know, it's shedding employees to various other companies around China. For example, Oppo set up its chip division. So I'd say that's what's kind of spurred it, and government money is great. I'd say it's better than nothing. Yeah, it's better than not doing anything. But I still see a lot of it being misdirected. Just throwing money at something doesn't always solve your problems, and sometimes it can create bigger problems. I think the HSMC situation is kind of the big example of that. Too many politicians making decisions rather than industry experts. I mean, the politicians kind of will say, look at this great big massive land I have for this new development zone, and look at these big shiny buildings, and big shiny buildings don't make chips. Yeah. So I think the other problem here is that now with situations like HSMC, local governments now have to be more wary about where they spend this money. So obviously, like last year, I can't remember what the number was, like 10,000 or more new companies with chip or semiconductor in their name trying to get government money. And so it spreads out to loads of companies, and what seems like a big chunk of government investment just becomes useless in like 10,000 different hands. But now when they're trying to be more selective, if you're a legit semiconductor startup with a really good idea and really good talent, you're having to now fight for investment with basically Ponzi schemes and tricksters. And so that makes it difficult for...
It reminds me kind of blockchain, like a couple of years ago, right? That you'd have, you know, somebody would have like, oh, this is the blockchain cafe. Or they just throw the word blockchain in their in their company name just to try to get some investment.
Yeah, it works. I mean, I do know of people where their goal is just to try and get some money and then do something for a couple of years and run away, basically. So it is a problem. And yeah, so I think it needs to be invested in the right places. And right now it isn't necessarily. I think China needs to invest more in talent and also attracting foreign talent. So I think we've seen some move in this direction with like the Nanjing Semiconductor University. And Nanjing's a good place for that, actually. Obviously, TSMC is there and Synopsys is there. And also Tsinghua recently, I think, as well, is now setting up a specific semiconductor, I don't know if it's department or a separate university. But this talent gap is super huge. I think I'm hearing that they think China in the next 3 to 5 years needs like hundreds of thousands of semiconductor engineers. And it's hard to attract graduates into that area when it's easier just to go to like an Alibaba or a Tencent. You get paid more and you don't need as much experience. So to be like the top expert at, say, in a software company, 10 years experience. In semiconductor, maybe 30 years. So it takes a much longer time to get there. And yeah, so
I've said this on the...
Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, I've said this on the podcast before, but I've heard that in order to be like an expert, like if to get hired as a high-end semiconductor engineer, you need to get a PhD. At that point, you're basically, you can be an intern and like you start to work with people who basically figured out what your PhD was about 20 years ago, but it couldn't become public because, you know, it's privately knowledge for the company. And then you can kind of work your way up and become a higher level expert.
Yeah.
Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I mean, and I certainly don't have a PhD, so please don't ask me to go into the details of how an ASML device works. But but yeah, you're right. It's super difficult. I mean, I think like basically even just like the accuracy you need when you're manufacturing a wafer, like the purity needs to be, you know, like 99.9999, whatever, how many 9%. And it has to be super flat. So like even it can't be up and down more than like 2 atoms. That's how flat it has to be. So this is the kind of crazy technology that you have to develop. It's not just I get a bunch of kids that learn C and then they can code a new application for me. It's something much more difficult than that.
Yeah, I mean, just I think
it's not a Chabudor type of business.
It's definitely not.
And it's also
I mean, I think half of just sorry, go ahead.
But it's something that I think is the strengths that we have seen in kind of China's digital economy over the last 5 to 10 years is so much of this like kind of lean startup sort of organization, right? You know, throw the spaghetti up against the wall, you know, create, just A-B test everything and try to figure it out, right? And this is just a completely different logic and a completely different kind of way of looking at research and development. And just it's so much less, can be so much less rewarding in the short term and requires just so much more investment of time and energy and resources.
Yeah, but I'm not, I mean, maybe you guys will know better, but I'm not sure like every VC in China understands the difference when you're investing in a semicon startup or a, you know, whatever, the latest social media app or whatever. It's different, yeah. It takes a lot longer to get to any kind of profit or revenue that is sizable, yeah. Mm-hmm. Just...
I do want to ask you...
I think...
go ahead.
I was just going to mention about the kind of self-sufficiency angle of this.
Yeah, so tell us more about
that. Yeah, so, well, I think a lot of the money that we're talking about has been going into... or most of it has been going to expanding capacity because the targets, whatever it is, like 40% last year when it's still 15%, 70% in 4 years' time, it's not going to get there. I think what they're really talking about is just how many of the chips are manufactured in China rather than any other kind of self-sufficiency. But even in that sense, nowhere near it. And this money is mainly going to this capacity. And who's the end beneficiary of that? It's the equipment companies, and most of those top equipment companies are foreign. So a lot of this big fund money is just going into the hand of foreign equipment companies anyway. So it helps boost their R&D as well. So they can help them stay ahead of the local companies like SME, AMEC, or Nora.
The HSMC thing, the thing that kind of struck me with that is that I think they did buy an ASML machine.
Yeah, they did.
Let's give a little context for our listeners about HSMC here. So first of all, for our listeners who might not be as deep into this, so what was the situation with HSMC? And then, so if you could summarize that for us.
Well, it's quite a long story. But from the top of my head, I think it started maybe 2-3 years ago. There was this guy, I forget his name, Tao or something like that. Oh, I'm not sure if that was his real name. And he and a couple of other guys basically had zero semiconductor experience, but they're very good at tricking local governments into getting money. And at the time, you know, you just say semiconductor and then you blurt that words like 7-nanometer, 5-nanometer, we can do this as long as you give us all this money. I mean, yeah, they even, because they'd got this machine from ASML, it wasn't an EUV machine, so it wasn't super cutting edge, but they got this equipment from ASML and they had all this government backing of like whatever, $1 billion, I think, in 2019. And then so they were managed to entice Jiang Shanyi, who's a TSMC veteran, a semiconductor veteran, and he used to work at SMIC as well, I think, and now has gone back to SMIC. So they managed to get him, so it all looked super legit. But now it's basically collapsed, and they never, I think the construction of the fab was completely wrong. They didn't actually know how to actually build one. And the guy...
Yeah, they used plans like from some other old fab that wouldn't work with current tech or something. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a big long story. I can't remember every detail, but yeah, basically it showed in the end, I think, that even... someone as experienced as Jiang Shanyi, who's from Taiwan, can be tricked by these Ponzi schemes. So I think in the end, it's quite detrimental for China to attract foreign talent. Like, you know, if I'm a Taiwanese engineer, is this company that's offering me double my wage actually legit? I mean, I need to do some more research here.
Yeah, so what I was saying is HSM, they bought that machine, and yeah, I don't know where the machine is now or what's being done with it. I think it was used as collateral for a bank loan, so maybe it's gotten auctioned off already or something. But
someone will want it.
I mean, I'm sure there's Yeah, I'm sure someone will want it, if not to take it apart, to try to use it for something.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't EUV. Mm. I'm not sure exactly what process node it worked to.
It was some sort of lithography machine.
Well, what I'm interested in here is, I mean, so it's your job to essentially kind of scope out the semiconductor industry on the ground in China. So from the perspective of investors that might be, you know, interested in some of these players, right? You know, this isn't something like, you know, these consumer facing companies that are much easier to get to know. This is something that's, you know, really complicated. Obviously, what we saw with HSMC is that there can be a lot of fraud involved. So if you're trying to discern the contenders from the pretenders here, the HSMCs from the real deal, what are some of the kind of variables that you're looking for that set apart the firms that are the real deal?
Well, I'd say if you're looking for companies that have, I guess, an opportunity for expansion in China, at least, because it's so dominated by Western firms in like the EDA and the equipment space, that I guess there's probably four things I can think of. So are they providing something that's currently dominated by the US or not? So for example, EDA. So it could be an opportunity in the Chinese market, even if, say, US player is currently dominant and the Chinese player has a worse product. But given the current situation, definitely someone that has a slightly worse product but would give the fabless design company a stable supplier, would be a stable supplier to them, then they would have an opportunity. And then from that, they can grow and then maybe get better and better. Are they providing something that's supported by the Chinese government? I think that goes for like basically any industry in China. If you know there's Chinese government support in a certain area, it's probably a safer area to invest in, because they'll get support from the government. Or are there easy non-US alternatives? So if there's like a European alternative, maybe it'd be more difficult for any Chinese company because, okay, I can't use this US thing, but, you know, Europe's friendly with us right now. I can just go to that. And so it'll be harder for a Chinese company to compete there. And then I think the other one, last thing I think of is just basically what we're just talking about. So who's in charge of this company? Because there's lots of dumb money around. So make sure it's not another HSMC. But obviously, it can be difficult because even guys like Jiang Xiangyu can be tricked, blinded by fancy shiny buildings. So yeah, make sure it's someone good. So I think it's someone. So I mentioned kind of EDA. So there's a company called XEpic, Xinhua Jiang, and they are basically trying to be the Synopsys or Cadence of China. Right now, it's super early days. I haven't met anyone that said that they're using XEpic, and I wouldn't say they're going to surpass Synopsys or Cadence in the next decade or something like that. But definitely they have room for growth for the reasons I just said. So I think we've seen recently Tom Cotton is trying to stop Chinese companies getting US EDA tools, which I think is a really stupid thing to do, but let's not go into that. But yeah, XEpic is basically doing a digital verification tool. Verification is like half the cost of chip design is basically in the verification process, and even like half the time, because you just basically need to make sure everything's right before you go to manufacturing, because if it goes wrong, then you're losing tens of millions of dollars and time as well. Yeah, so they are building a tool for this, a digital verification suite, and their founders are ex-Synopsys and ex-Cadence. They seem to know what they're doing. I think they have a lot of investment. Last year, ICCAD, which is the Chinese IC design expo, focused on IC design, they had like a tiny 3x3 booth. And I think this year I've seen the floor plan, and they have a huge booth next to Synopsys and Cadence. So they're obviously trying to go directly against them. So yeah, they seem to have good management. I think their investment now is, I think they're on maybe their fourth round recently. And yeah, I think it's like hundreds of millions yuan each time from guys like Hillhouse and Gen Fund. So yeah, that's one company I'd look at. There are few others that aren't, again, I guess, household names. So any of the RISC-V core vendors, so you have Alibaba, Nucleus, and Star5. Now, everybody knows Alibaba. Star5 is kind of like, I don't know if you know Sci5, but it's a US company, and Star5 used to be called Sci5 China. Now it's changed to Star5. So it's kind of like their arm China. But Nucleus is kind of 100% Chinese, and not as famous as Alibaba. So maybe it's a bit more interesting for people to hear about. The founder is super famous in the RISC-V circles. He had the first RISC-V book in China, if you want to learn and read about that in Chinese. If you're Chinese, is that good to read about how to do chip design in Chinese? and yeah, they have some investment from Xiaomi, some from Very Silicon, but mainly it's just owned by the founder, Bob, and his own management company. And I think companies like Nucleus can maybe gradually, I mean, right now they're kind of focused on IoT, of course, or IoT space, but I think they can gradually help China escape from this kind of clutches of ARM and x86. So they'll be interesting to look at. I don't know if they have any plans to list or anything, but I'll definitely keep an eye on them. Mm-hmm. And just, sorry. Yeah, go ahead if you have a question.
So I do kind of wonder, you know, you've referenced about how so much of this space is still quite dominated by these foreign players. You know, the names that I think a lot of our listeners will be familiar with is, you know, Taiwan Semiconductor, TSMC, ARM. What are, when we look at the kind of landscape, you know, what are these foreign firms that are currently dominating that landscape, and how do you see it kind of shaping up, and how can investors or our listeners who may not have a great understanding of the chip space in general kind of understand how that landscape looks like in China?
From my work, I've mainly been meeting with fabless design, so chip design companies, mainly those working on more high-end chips, so anything, so 16 nanometer and below. And so when I meet them, you know, like 99% TSMC or Samsung, because that's basically the only choice. Maybe you can have GlobalFoundries, or some of it can be SMIC, but if you're doing anything below 12 nanometer, that's your only two choices. TSMC, I think, is 80%+ of the leading edge market there. So, you know, companies like HiSilicon, wow, Unisoc, you know, ZTE, Alibaba, they all use TSMC, yeah. Because there isn't any other choice if they want to do a leading edge product. So, and TSMC, as I said earlier, they have a 16 nanometer fab in Nanjing, and they're building a 5 nanometer one in Arizona, of course, and nothing in Europe, unfortunately. Damn. Come to the UK. But yeah, most are always going to be in Taiwan, and they've said that on many occasions. So obviously there's some knowledge transfer will go on, especially, you know, with the fab in Nanjing, you know, their workers there, they moved to SMIC, etc. There'll be some knowledge transfer, but it's different doing something at 16 than it is at 7 or 5 or 3. So any of that kind of knowledge transfer will have to come from Taiwan itself. And I think
it does seem like a lot of that bottleneck kind of really is TSMC, like just that there is so much that only they can.
Yeah,
do.
I mean, Samsung is obviously the main competitor there, and they do have route to 5 and 3 as well, and beyond. They do have the money to be able to spend that much. You know, they have, unlike TSMC, they have many more different revenue streams. So I think, but Samsung is in the same situation as TSMC. Yeah. So if you're a Chinese company, it's blocked from TSMC, you're blocked from Samsung. Yeah. So either way, you need to rely on some outside company to manufacture a chip in the end. And I mean, that's what is killing the main thing that's killing HiSilicon. But if we talk about big Western players, I mean, I think maybe it if we stick to the choke points, because that is, I guess, what's most interesting to people. So, you know, everybody knows ASML, everyone knows LAM, everyone knows Applied Materials. From a LAM AMAT perspective, I think like local companies, Nora and AMEC, seem to be doing quite well, at least their marketing says so. I think they're down to on the etching machines, I think they can do like down to 12 nanometer now. But on the lithography side, like SMEE is like, it's like 90 nanometer or something. I think it's his best bit of equipment. So if you don't have that, then you can't make a chip. So anything below 90 nanometer, 100% need to use imported equipment. So there is this big reliance. So these Western companies they're making lots and lots of money in China. So if you cut them off completely from Western stuff, yeah, sure, they can't make anything, or they can't expand at least. But all that's going to do is push them develop these things themselves. So, you know, like we've seen with the automotive industry, yeah, China now makes great cars. How can they do that? Well, you make some cars in China, they open up a car in China, they find all the different parts, and then they go to the suppliers. You could do that with this. You find the LAM supplier, you apply to material,
which is all,
yeah, outsourced. You find each little part, and then you can start trying to make your own one. Yeah, obviously it's much more complicated than a car, take much longer, but you know, I think we all know not to write China off. Yeah, I think we've seen many a time how they surprise us in their ingenuity. And going on to the foreign EDA companies quickly, they work a lot with the universities here in China, so it's good to get the students to learn to use your design tools, so when they go into industry they're already used to that, and so they're less likely to want to use something else. And they also work with ICCs, I forget what they stand for, integrated circuit centers maybe, and you know, and that's basically a way for them to allow smaller Chinese design companies that don't have the budget to license Synopsys or Cadence tools directly. It's kind of a cheaper way to do it. So the ICC license it and then kind of gives cheap sub licenses to various smaller companies. But it's just a way to get people hooked onto their tools basically. And also a way to try to dampen down the kind of pirated tools industry. So if you can call it industry. So various times one of our clients was a design service company, and when you go to some Chinese companies and they're like, yeah, we can't prove that we have the official license for these tools, so can you still work with us? And obviously we can't say, no, we can't do that. Sorry. So yeah, it's very common. So the ICC is a way for these EDA companies to at least get some money from the market, even if it's way less than what they would usually charge. So yeah, all this, there's always a way to get hold of tools, even if companies are kind of officially blocked from using them.
Right, that's interesting. I wonder, so with EDAs and these tools, I wonder, is there also, you know, from the fab side or from the foundry side, do they need to have some sort of, I guess, spec that the tools have to have in order to design for, yeah. Do you know much about that?
A bit, not a load. So yeah, so what, at the end of the design process, you basically get a file format, which basically called GDS2, which is the format that you send to the fab, and they use that to tell the machines what to manufacture basically. And so the guys like Synopsys and Cadence, they always have to, they have a very close relationship with TSMC, Samsung, etc. So when they bring out a new process, say their latest 3-nanometer process, their tool is already ready to be able to integrate and be compatible with that new process and those new pieces of equipment to get that correct file, have the correct libraries, etc., to work. So that's one of the problems of someone like the company I mentioned earlier, Exepic, will have, is getting to the front of that queue to make sure their products will work with the latest processes when they come out.
And that's like another strength that TSMC and I guess Samsung have, is that they're kind of built in to these EDA systems.
Well, yeah, it's a strength they both have. Yeah, they kind of help each other. Yeah. I think finally, I haven't mentioned IP much, but I think we'll get onto ARM a bit maybe later. IP is another thing where it's all foreign, basically. I mean, as we mentioned with RISC-V, that's one area where China is kind of doing better, or can maybe replace ARM or x86 in some cases. It's a good platform for that. But you know, the processor core is just one part of a chip. Yeah, you know, there's USB IP or bus IP or graphics IP, etc. within a chip, within an SoC. And other than maybe VeriSilicon, which has like some GPU IP and some image signal processing IP, there's not really any strong local player. So that's another area where China is still catching up in a way.
Yeah, I want to get in a little bit more on this because also you have a hard out in a few minutes. So I want to touch on ARM, like you mentioned there. So just for our listeners, so ARM it's a chip maker. It's a British chip maker, right? But the from what I recall of the news story, they had kind of a power struggle when it came to their Chinese entity. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and what it means for kind of for investors in the landscape of chip makers in China?
Yeah, I mean, that was, I guess it's a bit like the HSMC story. It's another one of those like long meandering political corporate stories that just seems to go on. I don't quite know where to start and what order it all went in, but I think like it was summer last year. ARM proper, so British ARM, tried to get rid of Alan Wu, who's the CEO of ARM China. So because he basically had his own investment fund, apparently, he was basically offering, if you invest in my fund, then I'll give you discounts on ARM IP. And this was a conflict because one of the largest investments in ARM China was Hopu, I think is the Chinese name, Hopu, and they have their own like Hopu ARM Innovation Fund. So his own investment fund was competing with their own official ARM fund, and they didn't really like that. And so SoftBank said they wanted to get rid of him. ARM voted to get rid of him. Hopu wanted to get rid of him, and like ARM owns, I think, 49, just under 50% of ARM China, and then Hopu owns a lot of the rest. So way over 50% of ownership voted to get rid of him, but somehow he still didn't go. He's still there now. I think ARM even like put in like two or three executives or temporary CEOs to replace him, and then Alan fired them. Yeah, and I mean,
staged a coup.
Yeah, and some are saying he's holding up for more money, and ARM is saying, I think recently, that he's actually going to go like this year, maybe in September, but it's taking longer because of COVID. And actually, last I did see,
it's like if somebody loses a presidential election then doesn't leave the White House, essentially, right?
Well, that nearly happened. Well, yeah,
there's a little detail that I just think is kind of important that a lot of people don't know about China.
Yeah, sure.
I'll just try to do it quickly. I think Alan had the key thing in China and Chinese companies is the chops, you know, the little stamps. And if you have those stamps, the little red stamps that you put on documents,
the nuclear codes.
nobody. It's kind of like having the football case. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nobody can do anything because if you don't have those chops on a document, you can't send it to MOFCOM and get it, you know, officially approved. So if he has the chops and he's going to be fired from his own company, he can just not stamp them, and then they're not, you know, they're never official. So it's a key thing that, you know, it makes it so actually firing a high-level person in China is a lot more complicated.
It is. I think I was at a semiconductor conference in Shanghai, I think, late summer last year, and Alan did a speech there, and he had like a group of people around him when he was walking in and out. I wasn't sure if they were like his new bodyguard or protection that was around him, but I found that kind of interesting because I'd never seen him with that kind of entourage before. I think there's probably three things that are kind of coming out of this. I mean, a lot of companies, they think that if they're doing China, they always have to set up a local company, or it has to be a JV, something like this. But as you say, I think it really shows that you need to keep an eye on your local hire. You need to have some way to control the chops. Maybe use a service like ours. I think, obviously, I mean, Arm China kind of did it in a good way. I mean, they own 49%. The other investors were, I think, all Beijing-backed. But even in that situation, they still have this problem. So maybe it's showing that kind of, as far as Beijing is concerned, having control of Arm China is maybe more important than showing that you have a good investment environment that will protect your investment, you know, under rule of law. And I think the last thing is probably that is going to be quite, well, will may come to fruition soon, is the NVIDIA side of it. Obviously,
SoftBank selling Arm to NVIDIA, right?
So it could be used in some kind of negotiation with NVIDIA. I mean, if I was Beijing personally, I wouldn't want the NVIDIA deal to go through. I don't know why they would want to, unless they're getting something from NVIDIA, some kind of agreement on Arm China, maybe, I don't know. I mean, because it doesn't really make sense for Chinese companies. You're letting this IP, which you super need for so many chips, going into the hands of, one, a US company, which makes it slightly more problematic. And two, it doesn't make sense for anyone in the world that competes in any way with NVIDIA. So loads of chip companies, including loads of chip companies in China, will compete with NVIDIA somewhere. And then suddenly you're having to buy that IP off your competitor. It doesn't really make sense. So not just in China. I mean, the UK is getting kind of angry at this. And I know many people in the industry don't think, you know, not Chinese people, not Chinese companies, don't want that deal to go through either. So it'll be interesting to see if it does go through and whether China and Arm China get anything in return for letting it go through.
Yeah, but I think just a common theme that we're seeing throughout all this is just when so few companies and entities own such crucial assets and such crucial IP, such crucial capacity, it is something that kind of changes a lot of like the normal norms and expectations that we have around business, because it becomes something that is, you know, it's like the nuclear codes, right? It's something that just that contains so much power that you know, it really kind of changes a lot of the rules that we would normally come to expect around business. But anyways, Stuart Randall, thank you so much for joining us. How can our listeners read your stuff or learn more about your business or follow you on social media?
Yeah, so our company's intralinkgroup.com. So that's intra, so R-A, not inter, E-R. And you can follow me on Twitter at Stu Randall. That's S-T-E-W, like casserole or the food, Stu Randall. And also I write for TechNode. So I think maybe around once a month, I probably write a column I have on TechNode on semiconductor industry in China. So I think that's the main ways you can get in contact with me.
Wonderful. Thanks again. Thanks again to Stuart Randall for joining us. James, any takeaways that you have from our conversation?
Oh, yeah. I got a lot of new, like, extra names I need to kind of look at. I think, you know, the software systems is a really interesting space, and I've looked at that in the past. I'm full disclosure, I'm long TSMC, so obviously like all of that stuff. You know, one of the things we didn't get a chance to get to is the chip shortages that are kind of going on right now. And I'd like to maybe spend a couple minutes on that. But before that, you know, there's some characteristics, like foundational stuff about the semiconductor industry that I think, you know, obviously Stuart is aware of. We didn't talk about it, but that everyone who's kind of new to it needs to sort of understand. And that there are three things. One is that it's really capital intensive, which just means expensive. You have to buy lots of equipment. You have to buy expertise, or rent it. I guess you rent expertise. You need space. You need software. Okay. Number two is there's long investment timelines. So like if you want to start producing semiconductors, in order to produce, you need to go, if you want to produce today, you got to go back in time in your time machine and start investing, you know, years in advance. And then three is that yield is really important, because the you know, it's a complex multi-step process. if there's failure at any point in that process, it ruins the whole entire batch, right? And so semiconductors are created in like batches. And so if you have lower yields, you have more failures, your unit economics are worse, which means you basically live or die based on that. And it's a competitive industry as well. So if you don't have kind of the high-end tech frontier, which TSMC and Samsung have, you're competing on a commodity scale basis where absolutely the most important thing is efficiency. And that's not really, you can't even call that an advantage. It's like you have to, that's table stakes. You have to have that in order to even be in the business. So then the chip shortage. So kind of what happened, 2020, COVID hit, everyone's sales got decimated. Everyone that was buying chips, had orders to buy chips, canceled them because they had no idea when their sales would come back. Surprise, surprise, their sales bounced back in like 3 to 6 months. They need more chips again. They go back to the producers. Oh, by the way, if you want to get back in line, because, you know, we're producing chips for people to use, you know, 6 months later, you know, you got to put your orders in and you're going to be at the back of the line. Sorry, unless you can buy someone's spot farther up, but good luck. And so now we're in this position where there's this massive demand and supply gap, and it's not because of supply really changing. It's because demand did this big drop, and then surprise, you know, everybody that didn't buy a car in Q1 or Q2 still wants to buy a car in Q3, Q4, yeah, or next year, whenever they can. So it's not, you know, that type of good is something that can be waited, but it eventually will be bought. The problem is we have a few things happening. One, we have, because of this China, you know, the entity list kind of pushing China to get to accelerate self-sufficiency in semiconductors, that's creating what's going to be, not now, but going to be in the future, a massive increase in supply, okay? And that's assuming that they're able to get there. Let's just make that assumption, okay? And two, you have all the producers right now also trying to go, you know, they're building a plant in Arizona. Europe's even talking, I think TSMC's European guy said they might go there. I mean, this is even more supply, right? So eventually demand is going to kind of get to its regular level. All this extra supply is going to be coming on. It's going to bring back what used to be the case in semiconductors. And it's very similar to the mining sector in the terms of the lag between investment and CapEx in new mines and when those mines start producing. So it's going to bring back that kind of cycle, which means at some point in the future, when all these all this capacity comes online, if there's not, for some reason, some massive increase in demand, which, you know, and we're talking like a jump in demand, not like a gradual regular demand increases, but a big jump, then we're talking about it's just going to decimate the industry, and it's going to be really messy. So before you jump into...
It's not just semiconductors that we're seeing this in.
But the point is that before you jump into investing in semiconductors, you just keep this in mind that it seems like everything's all awesome and great for now, but there's going to be at some point, things are going to change, right? This is not going to be awesome forever.
Right. And this whiplash effect is something, I mean, we're seeing it consistently with, for example, the price of copper right now.
Yeah, lumber.
It's going through the roof. Lumber. Yeah. So just so many of these raw materials that, I mean, semiconductors aren't exactly raw materials, but that, you know, that their demand kind of got shaken up with COVID, right? And now they're kind of on the back end of that and it's just surging. But this is not something that we can count on happening for forever, and it's probably going to be getting back to normal sooner rather than later, I would assume.
Yeah, there's actually an interesting point there's an interesting kind of wallet share picture or analysis we could do here, where like because of COVID and because people couldn't travel and spend money on plane tickets, hotels, and, you know, rental cars and all this stuff, they had a lot more money to spend on other things, and that ended up being like home improvement, building homes, you know, things like that, which drove, just changed the whole demand picture for all these other goods, right? Other materials. So you wonder if COVID isn't done, which I don't know. We look at the numbers in India and you kind of wonder there, but if, you know, if when you're thinking about kind of the demand for all these things and how it's going to work out, you got to kind of look at the bigger picture, the wallet share, and if, you know, kind of how it's going to impact kind of the whole economy. And if we do get travel back, if we do get, you know, hotels and everything back to normal, that'll take away some of the disposable income, right? That's kind of found other places for now.
Yeah. Just before we sign off, I kind of mentioned this a little bit in the talk with Stu, but I find it really interesting how semiconductors are kind of, they run by almost the opposite dynamics of so many of these companies that we follow. In that, you know, we talked about Pinduoduo, for example. Essentially, you've talked about how their property, plant, and equipment, you know, is minuscule compared to their valuation, right? That they go from, you know, being this tiny startup to this massive, you know, $100+ billion company so quickly, without having to invest that much. And
well, they invest in, also in coupons and incentives and subsidies.
Yeah, and marketing, right? Yeah. But it's something where it's really easy for these companies to grow really quickly. And also they can, you know, they can, as Mark Zuckerberg said, you know, move fast and break things. And it's the semiconductor industry, it's like aviation or something like that, where you can't afford to move fast and break things. You know, because if you break one thing, that's breaking the business. So it runs by, in a lot of ways, the exact opposite logic of so much of the rest.
Yeah,
of
no, it's got physical constraints in like, by physical, I mean like the edge of, you know, modern, like the edge of bleeding edge of physics, right? Is they're dealing with materials science, physics, lithography, which is just like light, you know. So they like basically a silicon board gets sprayed with some metals, and then light hits it in a certain pattern, and it creates like an oxide layer that then needs to be washed off. But there's that created like a small transistor connection, and then another layer gets put on, and another layer, and another layer, and all these different, and it's just that's creating the complex semiconductors. And then you have software that's used to design. You can look in with the software into the very small, crazy shapes of all these transistors, and that's basically what they're working with. And if there's one of those is off, you have like a broken section of it. I think Intel's system was able to like turn off sections, so they could have more failures, but they would just like, okay, this, you know, i7 chip has less failures than the i3, but it just can't, you know, the i3 has more sections turned off. I'm probably completely wrong with that, but that's my understanding. Yeah, I could be completely blowing smoke here, but yeah, it's complicated. It's based in the physical world where things break. And if you break, you know, the internet connection for some of your users, yeah, then you're going to have a bad impact, but it's not going to, you get it back on and you're back to normal. You break a batch, you haven't perfected your yield system yet. You can't A/B test your way to a semiconductor fab. I mean, it's just like you're not going to get there, you know, ever.
Yeah. It's not move fast and break things. It's move slowly,
carefully,
and be precise
to the experts,
to the atomic level. Like, just so astoundingly, you know, you have to astoundingly precise. It's incredible.
There's a video on YouTube of ASML's UEV lithography machine, and one. So they're dropping a ball of, I forget the metal, maybe it's mercury or something. They're shooting a laser into it, and then they have to go through this lens, but they found out that the lens, it doesn't get small enough. So they did a little test, and they put a small drop of water in the lens that was at like another lens on top of the lens to make it even smaller, like laser shot, so it could make the right like a much smaller, you know, nanometer type size light beam that could do the lithography step on the semiconductor. It's just like,
this is Ant-Man shit. It's crazy.
It's anyway. Just like, yeah.
Anyways, we need to get moving. But yeah, thanks again to Stu for coming on, Stuart Randall. And thanks again to everyone at TechNode for making this podcast
review,
possible. Yeah,
please.
Give us a nice positive review. James Hull X on Twitter, Elliot Zagman, ELLIOTTGZAGMAN. And we'll catch you all next time on the China Tech Investor Podcast. Bye-bye now.